your children have you married off?
Three.
You have one more to go.
Daughter and two sons. If that young one gets married now, there's going to be trouble.
You have a pretty good insight into the youth of America, then. Is it as bad as sometimes painted? Do you disagree with a lot of the criticism against today's youth?
No, I do, very definitely. Because the young people that I see are bright and alert. They're very active, sort of full of mischief, some of them, but that's quite natural for young people. But they're good students. They're very anxious to work. And when you go to the high schools and the college campuses, you find them filled with great concern about things, about their country, about their college, about their future. Regrettably, it's the handful of the real extroverts that seem to get the notice.
Yeah, well, you run across these, what do you call them, Vietniks now, I guess, that picket against the war in Vietnam, and they've been rather rude to yourself and to President Johnson. What runs through your mind when you see them?
Well, they're not just rude to the president and myself. I think there's a mixture amongst that group. There are some that are very, very sincerely concerned about our present policies, and that's a healthy thing. I mean, in the sense that they provide a legitimate, articulate protest for some things that they disagree with. But there are some others that are really professional organizers, and those are very limited, but they're capable and they're clever. And we spot them all around the country. They sort of shift with the scenery. It's not unusual to find some of them are working different types of programs. I mean, they'll be on the Vietnamese issue, and then they'll be in some protest on some other matter.
Well, now, you were a school teacher, Mr. Vice President. How have students changed from the time that you taught?
Not appreciably, except I think they're a little more alert today. I believe that our young people are basically physically healthier, better food. They know how to. They've had better medical care. Many of them better conditions, economic conditions, and therefore their personal appearance, their personal health is maybe a little better. The education programs that young people have today are much better than they were 20 years ago, 30 years ago, by far much better. And I think there are, amongst young people today, I think there's a feeling that if they get an education, particularly in any specialized or professional area, that they have a great future. So there's a strong motivation.
Do you believe there's more pressure, we'll say, on the college student today than 25 years ago, 20 years ago?
Oh, no doubt about it. I mean, the amount of study that a young person has to do now in college is far more than 1930, 1925, 1935, 1940. Our universities and colleges have higher standards for entrance, much higher standards for staying than they used to have, and graduate school is a much more difficult assignment now than it was when I entered graduate school. No doubt about it. I watch the work of my own sons and daughter, and particularly my oldest son, and he's a good student, and his work in university and college has been much more demanding than anything that either his mother or father had to go through.
Do you find him asking you questions you can't answer?
Well, I find him argumentative and questioning. But this isn't unusual. They should be. They've grown up in a family where we have discussed most everything, and they ought to be inquisitive. They ought to have independence of judgment. For example, when I have told my boys that I expected them to do such and such politically, they'd say, well, we'll take a look at that. We'll think it out and see what we want to do. Fortunately, I must say that they've come around pretty well.
Actually, not to be facetious, has anyone asked you a question that you couldn't answer?
Oh, my goodness. Yes, one of the advantages of going to a professional school, I did first go to school in pharmacy, is that you either know the answer or you don't. In the field of social sciences, you can have many opinions. And those opinions may have some relevancy and some degree of truth. But as we used to say when we studied in courses in pharmacology or toxology or posology, whatever it was in pharmacy, you either knew it or you didn't. And when we were studying, we used to have a blackboard, and We'd ask the dose of a particular drug, and if you made a mistake on the exam, you not only made a mistake, you killed the patient, so to speak. So you had to be quite sure what you were doing.
Why did you leave teaching?
Well, I'm not sure I really did.
It didn't leave you.
No, I love to be at a college campus, and I like to be with young people. I left it at the time that I did because I wanted to be in public life, in the sense of public, of elected public service. I always had wanted to be an elected public official as a boy, and even particularly as a young man. But I have always sort of had in the back of my mind that someday I would return to teaching. I can honestly say that the happiest moments of my present public career are when I go back to a school for enough time to really absorb the environment and the atmosphere, to become a part of the workings and the environment of a university or a college campus, and to talk with students and to visit with them. In fact, I have some things in mind for next year where I will spend one or two or three days at a college campus as a sort of a student in residence or professor in residence, not at meetings, just being with young people and see how they're getting along, to exchange views and bull sessions, as we say, with sitting around at night. I think it'll be good for me, and I think it'll be good for them.
How much has your life changed, Mr. Vice President, since you took office some 2 years ago? Has it changed greatly for you and your family?
Yes, I would say somewhat. But public life, all areas of public life, have some common denominators. When I first was elected as a mayor of a city, my life changed a great deal. The real shock of public life is how little time you have with your family. And I've always had a guilt complex about this. You know, candor, I think, sometimes helps. Because my family means a great deal to me. And you just simply can't give your life to the public and at the same time give it to your family as much as you want. You have to try to draw some kind of a balance, and it's very fortunate if you have a wife that understands this, and I fortunately have had. I remember one senator, he's presently in the Senate, and a very fine public official. And one day he was in the Senate dining room, and he said to me that he was going to leave. He was with his wife and one of his sons. And he said to me he was going to leave to go on a vacation in the middle of a session of Congress. And I looked at him, and I was then the majority whip of the Senate, and I said, my good friend, you're going to have to make up your mind whether you're going to be a good senator or a good husband. I maybe shouldn't have been quite so abrupt, but there is a degree of truth to that, because I'm sure that his wife wanted him to give a couple of weeks off right then and there to go with the family. But we needed him in the Senate. Now, public life is somewhat like being in the military service. You don't always have easy options. And if you're going to do your job, you do what the job requires. And your wife has to understand that, your children have to understand that, your friends have to understand that, and you have to understand it. Now, I want you to know I rebel at the whole proposition a good deal of the time. I mean, I complain about the fact that I don't have time to do the things I want to do. For example, here I am vice president, and I don't even get a chance to drive a car. And I supposedly have two places to live and don't have much time to live in either one of them. Lovely home in Minnesota. I get a day or two out there, maybe 3-4 days a month in the summertime. And I have a nice home in Washington.
How is that home, that new apartment, by the way? Do you like it?
Oh, well, it isn't done yet. You know, I'm growing to like it. Now, your question is quite helpful.
Well, see,
right
Governor
now.
Lawrence here, he moved from a home into an apartment, and something similar. Well, of course, he's not the vice president, but you moved from a home into an apartment. And he's not so wild about it.
Well, my wife tells me that every important move that I've made, that she's helped me make that decision, and there's some truth to that. I grew up in the Depression, and the one thing that I've always abhorred is debt. Now, I know when I talk to lawyers and them and all these intelligent financiers, they tell me you can charge off a lot of this interest and everything, but it's that monthly payment and that mortgage that gnaws at me.
A vice president has that problem?
Are you kidding? So that When you get ready to move, you know, first of all, that it's going to cost you more than you ever thought it would. That your wife doesn't really tell you that, your friends don't tell you that, and the real estate agent doesn't tell you that. But later on, you find out, but you continue to do it. It's a habit that's costly, but you continue to do it. We're going to move into a very nice apartment, hopefully within the next month, and I think it will be a very nice place to live. I've never lived in an apartment, and very candidly, it took a good deal of convincing, but I'm getting better at it. Really, I'm softening. It kind of bothers me that Mrs. Humphrey is getting her way so easily on this, but she decided some time ago that we are living out too far, and this morning when I drove to the airport, I found out she was right. It took about 50 minutes to get there. So we'll be in close to the capital, close to where we should be, and only a few minutes from the airport.
Do you think there'll be some general disappointment among some people that the number two man in this country doesn't live in a magnificent house?
No. As a matter of fact, I've been thinking about that. I suppose it would be nice to have a vice presidential home. I think the country ought to have one in due time. And as you know, Congress has authorized it. And when it first was authorized, I received all kinds of letters saying, so you're going to get a new house at the taxpayer's expense. And I would write back and say, listen, the man that will live in that house hasn't yet been born, because it takes government a long time to work these things out. And I doubt that there will be any vice presidential home for some years to come, even though I think for the good of the country that this, as that office grows and develops, that this would be helpful. But as far as we are concerned, we'll get along very nicely. In fact, we do right well where we are. People say you ought to entertain a little more. Frankly, I'm not so sure, but what, everybody entertains a little too much. Sometimes it might be a good idea if you just go home and sit down and read and quit entertaining.
Mr. Vice President, when is the Congress going to get around to fixing a better system of presidential and vice presidential succession?
Well, the Congress has. It's now before the several states.
But it's been stalled for quite a long time.
Yes, but we have a constitutional amendment, and I believe it's passed over 30 states. And when it finishes the 38th state, or goes through the 38th legislature, it will become a part of our Constitution. And then we will have a fixed succession policy. Presently, as you know, we have an agreement between the president and the vice president relating to succession and disability, which is filed with the attorney general. This was done under the administration of President Eisenhower with Mr. Nixon, then followed by President Kennedy, and then the vice president, Mr. Johnson, and now President Johnson and myself. And a succession amendment will fix the policy so that there'll be no doubt as to how this is to take place.
And while the president's on this upcoming trip of his, you have to hang close, so to speak, to Washington, do you not?
Reasonably so, sir, but not really in, you know, just tied down. Wherever the president is, he is the president, and wherever he is, he carries with him the full sovereign power of the United States. One thing a vice president needs to remember is he is not president. And he needs to remember that his functions are delineated by law and by Constitution. And he ought to stay within those functions. I will stay reasonably close to Washington, primarily to take care of some matters that may come up, some visitors that come through that might have wanted to see the president and he will not be there. The Secretary of State, for example, is going to be with the President on part of his journey. I will handle a few meetings that the Secretary of State was going to have. These are minor meetings. I don't mean any big diplomatic meetings. For example, the United States Association for the United Nations is having a meeting in Washington. I will be working with some of the cabinet officers on matters that are of importance to the country. But I don't think one ought to portray to the public that when the president goes overseas, that the government, so to speak, stops, or that the vice president has to take over. That is not the truth. The fact is that the president's communications, whether he's in Tokyo or in Paris, or if he were in Santiago, Chile, or up in Canada. It wouldn't make a bit of difference. His communications are as good as picking up the telephone right here and calling home, so that he is in charge. I've talked this all out with the president, and we understand fully what the situation will be and is.
You said that one thing the vice president must bear in mind is that he is not the president, but can you be a vice president without thinking that one day you would like to be president?
Yes, you really can. As a matter of fact, I think that's
you
one...
You can or you cannot?
You can be vice president and not think about being president, not wanting to be president. I would imagine that the one sure way that you could have some doubts as to whether you wanted to be president is to be close enough to the president of the United States to watch what he has to go through. Now, do I make myself clear? When you're removed from it, in other offices or not in public office, you look at that office, and it is a grand office. It is an office that, represents everything that this country stands for. And, of course, it's the most powerful office in the world. And it has a fascination about it. But the closer you get to it, the more you see the unbelievable burdens that the president has to carry, the difficulties he has to face, the decision-making process through which he must put himself, and the fact that he just gives his whole life, must give his every bit, every living moment to it. So you have mixed emotions. On the one hand, if you're in public life, as I am, or as many others are, I suppose it's fair to say that you do think about the possibility that you could become president or might want to be president or would be president. But I've watched two presidents now at close hand. I wasn't as close, of course, with President Kennedy as I am with President Johnson. Nevertheless, I was a good friend of President Kennedy and worked very closely with him, watched him through the Cuban Missile Crisis, and many others. And it is a most exacting business. And I've watched President Johnson make decisions relating to our economy in Vietnam. And I must say that this isn't something that you just get up and say, hooray, I'd like the job.
Well, if you don't want to be president, Mr. Vice President, what about that interim period between the time you complete your term as vice president and you go back to teaching? Now, there's a gap there. What happens during that period?
I'm going to have to ask you for advice, I'm afraid. I don't say that one wouldn't want to be president. I think what I'm saying to you is that you sense that all of the so-called luster and glamour that many people attach to the highest political office, while that luster and glamour is there, there's also the pain and the burden and the responsibility of that office. And if I have had any experience that is meaningful to me, it is to watch President Johnson be president. And he is a president that knows how to be president. He knows how to conduct a government. He knows how to administer agencies. He understands the intricacies and the complexities of the decision-making process. And I would be less than honest with you if I didn't tell you that I study this very carefully, because that is my duty. I think you have a right to know that I am interested and that I do try to know what goes on in our country and how they prepare a budget, for example, in the Department of Defense, the network of intelligence that we have that brings information to our government and how it operates and how you evaluate intelligence, how you formulate policy. These are not matters that you learn overnight. I've been in government 18 years, and after 16 years, I knew how to be a senator. If I may say, I thought I really knew how to be a good senator.
Would you be surprised, sir, if President Johnson stopped off in Vietnam on a scheduled Asian trip?
I wouldn't be
sort
able
of
to
a have you stop beating your wife question.
I wouldn't be able to give you any response to that, because only the president himself will make a decision like that, and anything that I could say surely wouldn't... I think add any light to the subject, because I surely don't know what he has in mind, except that he said he's not going to go.
Well, let me follow it up with a local political question then. Do you believe it helps for someone like yourself to come in and campaign for, you must believe it helps, and the candidate must, for, we'll say, Milton Schaap, who is running for governor in the Democratic ticket? Does it stir up the local folk to be more enthused over Mr. Schaap?
I hope so, and apparently Mr. Schaap feels so. I've had the privilege of knowing Mr. Schaap not only as a man that seeks public office, but as a friend and as a man in industry, very successful industrialist. You know, you get to know a man a little better when you sit in his home. You don't really get to know people so well when you're out running around the country campaigning. Everybody's moving too fast. But the quiet, leisurely moments sitting around the house and meeting the family and talking to the man's wife and seeing his children and talking to his neighbors, that's the way you get to know a man. And apparently, well, I got to know Mr. Schaap that way, and I like him, I respect him. We are friends, and that, I think, is the nicest part of all of this that we're doing. He is of the opinion that that at least my presence here doesn't hurt him, and hopefully it might be of some help in arousing the politicos, the Democrats, and hopefully the independents to do a little more in his behalf, and I think they should. In fact, that's the whole reason I'm here.
You know, I should ask you to confirm this, because I've always heard it secondhand, but you have been credited as being the founder of the Americans for Democratic Action.
One of the many, yes.
One of the many. Well, I just wondered if, since you became vice president, if you are not put in a somewhat embarrassing position sometimes because of your affiliation with the Americans for Democratic Action.
No, as a matter of fact, to the contrary. I served in the Senate, where I had to exercise independence of judgment for 16 years, and I was the deputy leader and the majority whip, which required that I really work closely with the president, President Kennedy, and then later on President Johnson, because I was their agent, so to speak, in the Senate. Now, I didn't always agree with the resolutions of ADA, or should I put it this way, they didn't always agree with my actions. But the Americans for Democratic Action is not a dogmatic organization. One of the reasons that it was organized is so that you could have a little independence of judgment. You don't have to goose step, you know, and march a straight line. I know most of the people in ADA, and they're all as independent as can be. The amazing thing to me is that we agree on anything. I mean, that you get a consensus amongst them.
Well, you're right that they're independent. We have a local situation here that kind of points up their independence. There is a congressional race going on between the incumbent, James Fulton,
yes,
and the Democratic candidate for Congress, who is Steve Arnold. And the ADA here came out for the Republican,
yes,
congressman. Well, now, that's kind of unusual, isn't it, since you're a Democrat and you're one of the founders of the ADA?
Yes, but the ADA is not an auxiliary of the Democratic Party. It is an independent organization. It's entitled to make some mistakes.
You think
it's and and
well,
it's
you're
also...
Talking, you're
it's
talking
also
about Washington's bachelor sweetheart, Jim Bolton.
Well, I think well of Jim. I don't want to... I was being a bit facetious, and I do support the Democratic candidates, but I don't go traveling around the country berating or downgrading the members of Congress. Now, we have honest differences of opinion on some issues, but I have yet to find a member of Congress, at least I haven't found very many, that I didn't find something that I liked about them. I live with these men, and I know them, and I like most of them very, very well and respect all of them. In this instance, I would hope that you know that I'm a Democrat, you know that I believe in the Democratic Party. In most Democrats I support. I don't always support all of them. For example, I just couldn't go into the state of Georgia and support Mr. Maddox. I just couldn't do that. And he's a Democrat. He doesn't ask me. I'm sure he doesn't want me, frankly. But I wouldn't go, because I think you have to put principle above narrow partisan considerations. When you put basic principle, now I'm not talking about whether you think the minimum wage ought to be $1.30 or $1.35. That's not principle. That's arguing over detail. But when you get down to where you're talking about a philosophy of life, and where you're talking about human dignity, where you're talking about basic human rights, I consider that a matter of principle. And very frankly, I don't believe in supporting people that violate what I think are the right principles of conduct and government in this country.
Hmm. I'd like to get back a little bit to the private side of the Vice President of the United States. You mentioned before that there are some things you cannot do as Vice President, such as spend time with your family or not enough time.
Oh, I spend some. I'm just selfish about it.
And you can't drive a car. What do you do when you want to buy a suit? Can you just walk into any place and buy a suit?
I do.
Do you?
As a matter of fact, I do. And I have a dear friend, I'll tell you, up there in the Wheaton Plaza, and Washington, they won't accuse me of a commercial from
we'll
here.
We'll send him a bill. That's all right. Mention his name, we'll send him
but,
a bill.
But he's a wonderful tailor, and I go up there and buy my clothes, and when they don't fit just right, he comes out and fixes them up, and I like it that way. I want to go and do some shopping. I go to my own drugstore, over to Packett's Pharmacy, and I like to go on over to their delicatessen, I love to go on in there and have a good time and joke with the fellows a little bit. And I get by with that pretty well in the neighborhood.
What kind of delicatessen do you like?
Oh, my goodness. Now, don't get me into that.
How do you stand the physical strain, Mr. Vice President? And you're flying around the country. You go from here to Pittsburgh. I understand you go to Massachusetts tomorrow. How do you stand that physically?
Well, most of the time, frankly, I feel good. I've been blessed with good health. I don't feel as good in the mornings as most people do, because there are two kinds of people. There are morning people and night people. I guess I'm a night one, you see. I work late nights. I like to stay up.
Well, morning people are very odd people. Morning people.
Yes,
they're very odd. You know, they get up 7 o'clock, 6 o'clock.
I know. But I generally go to bed around 2 o'clock and 1:30, 2 o'clock. And I don't care to be having somebody telling me I have to be at the airport at 8 in the morning. Now, even though tomorrow morning I'm going to be there at 7:45. There are some people that you get working for you that don't quite understand that, you see. And I do grouse around about these things. I'm entitled, my wife tells me that I'm entitled to be reasonably unhappy and sort of mean and aloof up until 10. After that, why, in the morning. After that, I should settle down and behave.
Are you difficult to work for, Mr. Vice President?
Oh, my, of course not. You ought to see how happy all of them are. But, no, I think we have a good time, most of us. May I just add the one note to that? I believe that if your work is not really fun or enjoyable, that it will wear you out. And many times people ask me about, the question that you put to me, travel a great deal, you go hard. What does it do to you, your physical condition? Well, everyone tires, there's no doubt about that. You can't keep it up forever. But in the main, if you're happy with your work, mm-hmm. you are not really very tired. You may be a little physically tired, but you're not really exhausted, and you're not nervously exhausted. And I love to be out with people, and I like to campaign, and I truly enjoy public life and politics. I like it, and because of that, I find myself feeling pretty good.
What about the campaign in California? How do you look upon it right now, between your friend Governor Brown and Ronald Reagan?
Well, I can only give you an outsider's point of view that is very objective from a Democratic Party angle. I think really that Governor Brown has made great gains. He was, I know, and he knew that he was far behind in the summer after the primaries in California. But I was there in the latter part of September, and most of the people that I talked to, old friends of mine that are not too political, told me that they thought Governor Brown had closed the gap, and they were predicting that he would come through. He wears well. You know, the people finally come down to the conclusion that to be governor of that great state, which grows rapidly, is a tremendous responsibility. And Pat Brown has two or three characteristics that I think carry him through. Number one, he's very frank and candid.
If we disagree, what do we do? Well, Mr. Vice President, this trip, how was it arranged? Whose idea was it? And I ask that because the opposition will say that you're here because Mr. Schapp's campaign is in trouble.
Oh, my goodness. As I've told some other friends today that I don't like to go places where there's trouble. There's enough trouble in Washington. If I wanted trouble, I'd stay there. No, I'm here because Mr. Schapp and myself, Mel Schapp and the Vice President, Hubert Humphrey, are good friends of long-time association. We've worked together on many programs. One of the programs that we really worked together on was our Youth Opportunity Program, where Milt was the first to come on in and be helpful in the employment of young people, needy young people. And when he was nominated as governor, and I was delighted that he was, and he knows it, we got together, and he thought I might be of some help in some areas of this state just to come along with him. So I'm here for that purpose.
But when all is said and done, Mr. Vice President, how much good is accomplished by people named Humphrey and Eisenhower and Kennedy to make appearances in behalf of gubernatorial candidates when, after all, in the final analysis in Pennsylvania, for example, when it comes to voting, we'll have to vote for a man named either Schaap or Schaefer?
Well, I've often wondered but just how much good we were able to perform myself. It's a part of the pattern of public life, and vice presidents long before Hubert Humphrey have been running around doing this, and they'll be doing it afterwards, and gubernatorial candidates will put up with us and tolerate us in both parties. Hopefully that at least you arouse some enthusiasm amongst the supporters of the gubernatorial candidate, of the governor candidate, and of other candidates. We're not here just, you know, for Mr. Schaap. We have some fine Democratic members of Congress, and those that seek to be members of Congress for the 90th Congress, and Democratic members of the 89th Congress that deserve a pat on the back. And I imagine that the Vice President of the United States, who works rather closely with the Congress as the presiding officer of the Senate, is in some position to know how well a man has done. And I come here to pay them my respects and to urge people to keep them on the job. I might also add that it's kind of nice just to come to Pennsylvania. You have a wonderful state.
We agree there.
And I want you to encourage tourism.
Do you think, sir, that in your travels around the country and, of course, Pennsylvania, that you find one overriding issue in all campaigns, such as Vietnam, such as civil rights?
No. Now, you do not. Not in an off-year election, sir. We have a record, the national administration, on which we, come to the voters with that record. We have the record of the 89th Congress, the record of the Kennedy-Johnson, the Johnson-Humphrey administrations. We think that's a good record. We speak of it. We remind the people of it. They don't really need too much reminding. I think they understand it. But in these off-year elections, congressmen generally run on the basis of their record and their contacts in their community and many local issues. And obviously, candidates for governor have their own programs and their own platform. For example, Mr. Schaap has made a very important contribution in the politics of Pennsylvania on the matter of education. This state ought to lead the nation in education. It ought not to follow. It ought to lead the nation. And Mr. Schaap is telling the people of Pennsylvania that, and I think they'll agree with him because they're a proud people and they have every right to think that this great state where our country was born, for all practical purposes, ought to be the state that leads this country into the future.
To move on to the world matters, Mr. Vice President, according to reports, yesterday's meeting that President Johnson had with Soviet Foreign Minister Gromyko would seem to be the first major breakthrough in East-West relations. What do you think we can expect from that meeting?
Well, of course, the President's address in New York of last week on the European policy, U.S. policy in Europe, and particularly with the emphasis upon the relationships between Eastern Europe, the Soviet bloc, and the United States, I think was highly significant. I believe this had a very favorable impact, not only in Western Europe, but also in the Soviet bloc countries. You don't get anything quickly in these matters. What you seek to do out of a visit such as the President had yesterday with Mr. Gromyko is to encourage an environment in which the meticulous detail of diplomacy can be carried out, an environment that is conducive to reconciliation, an environment, a diplomatic, political environment that promotes the adjustment of disputes and the better understanding between nations and peoples. And I must say that one of the really encouraging signs of the day is the capacity of the President, President Johnson, to talk face-to-face with the leading diplomats of the world and to make a very favorable impression upon them, and at the same time, to state the case of the American people clearly, forcefully, and yet without irritation. As you know, the president has seen a number of the leading statesmen of the world. His visit with Mrs. Gandhi of India, I think was very helpful in our relationships. With President Ayub of Pakistan, I was in on those conferences. The frank talk that he had with President Ayub of Pakistan had a great deal to do with the settlement at Tashkent a year ago between India and Pakistan. His visit with President Marcos of recent date undoubtedly led to the conference which is now taking place in Manila. His visits with Prime Minister Wilson of Great Britain and of Chancellor Earhart of Germany have produced tremendously great results for the British and for the relationships between ourselves and those countries. So I feel that this recent contact with Gromyko is a very healthy development and a good sign.
One final question, sir. You sound more encouraged about the prospect of peace now than, say, 6 months ago, 3 months ago? Peace in Vietnam.
I believe there's reason to feel that, some cautious encouragement. I've used the word cautious optimism. That may be a little bit too much. Let me put it this way. I know that more and more people throughout the world fully appreciate the sincerity of the American desire for a peaceful settlement in Vietnam. This is highly important. I think that the peoples in Southeast Asia also understand the persevering patience that we have, the determination that we manifest, and the will that we have to stay and see it through. And this combination of perseverance and of will and determination, plus the artful use of diplomacy, I believe has some hopes within it of progress towards better understanding and hopefully towards peace. I want to be very careful. I don't think one should jump to any conclusions that we have any quick and easy way out of the present situation in Southeast Asia. I do think that militarily, we're making considerable progress. Politically, with the election in South Vietnam, considerable progress. Economically, South Vietnam is better today than it was 6 months ago by far. Diplomatically, our efforts at the United Nations, the recent efforts of the President, the recent efforts of the British Commonwealth and the Prime Minister Wilson, Utant, the Secretary General of the United Nations, I think diplomatically, these have all contributed to a healthier and a more hopeful climate of leading to some prospect of peace. But let's not try to make it appear that it's going to come around the corner tomorrow, because it won't.
Thank you, Mr. Vice
President.
Thank
you, Mr.
Well, what about my friend Milt here?
This is a conference with the Vice President of the United States.
We've got plans for Mr. Taft.
You would take him on now?
We take him on all the time.
Well, you know, you were asking one question before. I'd like to reply to it about the visit of the Vice President, what effect it has on the campaign. I agreed with the question more than was indicated, that I think it stirs up a lot of interest to have the Vice President and Senator Kennedy and so on come into the state, and certainly if the president gets back from Manila in time to come into the state. But I think it really depends upon the candidate projecting his own programs. The people coming from the outside can say, yes, we believe that such and such a candidate, whether it be in Pennsylvania or Massachusetts or wherever it may be, can do a job. But if the candidate himself doesn't project his own programs, his own ideas, I don't think that the outside expressions of confidence really wear off on a candidate. I think this has been shown in campaign after campaign.
Well, you see, you had the last word, Mr. Schaff.
Well, we finally got into the program. As long as you're talking about Vietnam, you're out of my province. As soon as you
education, we're in your province.
Oh, yes, if you talk education, I'll be glad to sit here all day, but that isn't what we want to do.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.